thank you for being on Podcasting Them Softly, Dr. Boll.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
All good.
I have to say, I was very upset when you decided to stop making movies, because I'm a big fan of your movies.
Yeah, sorry, I have a little cough.
Yeah.
The problem is, of course, the fact that the old market, how we know it, with theatrical and DVD revenues, is gone. And now you basically have new players like Netflix, Amazon, Hulu,
right.
And I'm not really close enough connected to them to make big deals to get a movie financed.
Right.
So my decision to stop making movies was really just forced by films cost money, and I cannot refinance in the old way movies anymore. So
right.
It means I could come back making movies, but then we need Netflix or Amazon, Hulu, whatsoever, stepping up and actually paying a movie.
Right.
You know, I mean, that is how it goes, and it's too bad what happened, and so I was basically 50 years old, forced to stop making movies.
Yeah. Oh, that's a real shame. I was kind of hoping to to write an Uwe Boll film one day, but
yeah.
I'm glad for the films that you did make anyway. But anyway, so we're talking a little bit about Sean Scholl has made a wonderful film about you.
Yep.
It's called Fuck You All. the Uwe Boll story.
He picked the title. It's not my choice. So.
Yeah. he said that you liked parts of it, that you didn't like all of it. Is that true?
No. I'm so sorry about my coughing.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a very good documentary. So, it's, trying in, like 1.5 hours to basically show, a picture of me, what is not so out there. And it's not basically, only focusing on like the nerds or the reviews, right? So, or the fact that I whatever boxed against my critics. And that is what I, when you showed me the first version of it, I said, I would really appreciate if you can actually talk about my, or show a little more about my movies. The movies I actually did, right? So, and go a little away from the video game based movies and focus on like there's Darfur, there's Assault on Wall Street, Rampage, Tunnel Rats. There are a lot of movies I did that are, basically, about the real world we're living in. And, so I think, that he changed it then, and the new edit, like the new finished version, I think it's a good one. It's entertaining. It's it has humor. It has a lot of people talking about me. And not only people that watched some movies, also people I worked with a long time, like Dan Clark,
yeah.
Brian Knight, my AD, Dan Clark, the line producer. You know, so and I think that is he did a good job.
Yeah.
And of course, I always, as a filmmaker or whatsoever, I always wished more stuff about my movies and less about fighting with reviewers. The one thing I didn't like is basically, I think the guy from the Razzies got too much space.
Right.
You know, the Raspberry Awards, the Razzie Awards. I mean, I never met that guy. He watched maybe 5 of my movies in total from 30 movies I did.
Mm.
And he basically has almost 15 minutes in the documentary where he talks.
Yeah.
And I think that is a little, that was a little too much room for a guy like this. But okay. I mean, in a way, I understand him too. But I'm very positive about the doku. And I think there was that other doku about me, Raging Ball, years ago that was basically only about the reviews and only about the boxing matches.
Yeah.
And that I didn't like because I mean, I like the boxing footage, but I didn't like the way Dan West, the filmmaker, portrayed me.
Yes.
You know, I didn't make movies for reviewers. I made movies for people and for myself, the stories I wanted to tell.
Mm.
And I was definitely forced to, in a way, to make all the video game-based movies because I was able to finance them.
Yes.
I mean, film costs money, right? So, yeah. And I didn't work a lot with like subsidies. So for me, I needed to raise private capital to make movies. And with House of the Dead, after House of the Dead made money, I was able to raise more money with Alone in the Dark and other movies like this.
Mm. But as I said to Sean, what really needs to be taken away from your story as well is that you are an exceptionally talented producer, as well as a director and a writer and all that sort of thing, because like any sensible producer, you needed to go after properties that had commercial, you know, that were commercial, that could be, you know, made for a nice budget and that had already a built-in audience so that you could sell the films based on that. I mean, that's just smart producing, yeah?
Yeah, I got that you see it this way. I mean, that was a thing also where I felt, being connected here in Vancouver to the film industry, and I see so many productions, amateurish, going over budget. Like people, let's take Bryan Singer as an example. I know him since X-Men. He shot at the next studio door from Alone, where we shot Alone in the Dark. And he never went, brought a movie in on budget, on time. He always fucked everything up and didn't came and stuff like this, right? So, but then a guy like this got movie after movie after movie after movie and got hired by the studios, over and over again. Mm. And, every single time the production ended up going way over budget. And that is what the mystery of Hollywood, what I don't get.
Yeah,
you know, it's like this kind of like why nobody came back to me and said, let's produce movies together. I mean, 32 movies, every single one I brought in under budget, and I didn't get any credit for it.
Yeah,
and I mean that is the thing. It's so absurd how the film industry works, and that is one of the reasons what I said in the beginning with Netflix and so on. They also grab the same filmmakers what the studios grabbed before, and I have the feeling like if you don't have Brad Pitt, you don't get a job.
Exactly.
You know, stuff like this. And, exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, another thing too that I was talking with Sean about yesterday is the fact that if you had have come along, right, and made your first, you know, movie in North America, and it had to been an absolute bomb financially, then you probably might not have gotten a chance to make any more movies, unless you did it independently.
Absolutely.
Yeah, unless you did it independently, which you did.
Yeah. No, I agree, and it's also a thing like when I remember when Alone in the Dark came out and it made only $5.8 million box office in US, and everybody was saying like, oh, what a disaster, blah, blah, blah. But if you really think it through, look at the last 3 years, for example. You know how many huge movies with huge stars, with huge production budgets made no box office, made a million or 2 million box office.
Yeah.
And, you know, but when I had something, I got bashed into like the worst of the worst, and other things getting just like forgiven, you know, like they don't care, they don't get harsh criticized. And I got like overly harsh criticized, and then all my follow-up movies from Postal, starting with Postal and so on, got not the credit they should get.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the thing what I think only film critics and people like you and so on can correct this.
Yeah.
For film history, right? So I mean, to be honest, like a lot of the movies, if I compare my Darfur film with Moonlight, who won the Oscar for best movie of the year, I think Darfur is better. And Assault on Wall Street was a great movie. Rampage 1 was a great movie. And the best I got was that they were okay.
Yeah.
You know, because people, they're always like, oh, I cannot really give Overball the credit. Because that has a negative impact on the critic himself if he would say, oh, we were like dead wrong about Ball, actually. But and that also didn't really come across in the documentary I think I get some credit there, but I didn't get the credit for some really important movies like the Buffalo movie. Mm. And yeah, but it's still better.
Yeah.
As there would be no other documentary, Bob.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a bit like Keith David says in the documentary that it seems today that the success of a film is based on whether how much money it brings in. Like, it seems the magic number, if it breaks $500 million worldwide, then it's a successful movie.
Yeah, I know. But think about that. Like, what movie's making $500 million? Like,
yeah.
I mean, not too many.
Yeah.
And but that is now what the studios are doing, and the streaming service is doing that $20 million movie.
Right.
$30 million movie.
Yeah.
And it looks like nobody reads the scripts. Everybody basically says, you have Brad Pitt, boom, money. You have Will Smith, boom, money.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is when I'm a big fan of Netflix, some like episodical shows, Narcos, whatever, El Chapo, this kind of stuff I really like.
Yeah.
But the individual movies Netflix are doing
are
horrible.
Yes.
I mean, they're mostly, like, really crap, right? I just watched yesterday that Coen Brothers Western thing they did there. I mean, I never saw a worse movie from the Coen Brothers.
Really?
And,
okay.
It's almost like, I don't know, they sell them, they make their movies what nobody else wanted to finance ever, and then they make them.
Right. But, and they're spending an awful lot of money. I mean, I read somewhere that the script for that Will Smith Netflix movie, they spent nearly $4 million on the script, to buy the script.
Yeah, I know. That is the other thing what is a miracle for me.
Yeah.
That some stuff is just the Bright movie, that it was an okay sci-fi cop movie kind of thing, but maximum okay, I would say. But
yeah.
But why $4 million?
Exactly.
Right, so, yeah, that is the thing. And I just don't get it. I mean, I have, for example, a great, a project what a guy wrote, Whitney Bain, he wrote it. It's about from Elliot Ness, like the Untouchables and stuff like this. So Elliot Ness was a real cop in real life. And before the movie Untouchables basically started, he cleared up his first big case, was a serial murder case, a serial murder in Kingsbury Run in Cleveland. And a guy wrote like an 8-episode, 10-episode miniseries.
Hmm.
And I'm not getting any financing for it.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you think about it, like Elliot Ness, everybody knows it's a movie, Untouchables, everybody knows. Why that doesn't get financed?
Yeah.
If I would be Ron Howard, I would just get a check.
Yeah.
And it would be financed. And that is the thing where I hoped with the streamers like Apple, Google, whoever goes in content, that they also kind of pick sometimes different people that were not really in the studio system to produce for them. But
yeah.
They don't. They just hang out in Hollywood and with name dropping, and most of the production companies who they work with have an actor as part of the production company.
Yeah.
That is the new green lit situation.
Yeah.
It seems to be
a very incestuous town, Hollywood.
Yes, absolutely. it's really like who knows who.
Yeah.
The agent knows the producer knows the studio, and instead of going against the trend and also doing maybe things totally against the old-fashioned way, I have the feeling that Amazon and whoever enters that business, they are just fascinated and want to be part of it.
Yeah.
You know, they're not saying now we rewrite the business and we go away from that stupid manager, agent, Hollywood as we know it, and we just look plainly at the facts and go also with producers with a track record they can actually deliver on budget. They don't go over budget or whatever, but no, they do the same thing what everybody else did before.
Yeah. One thing I thought was interesting in the documentary that Sean put in there, it was a comparison to, you or your films with Tommy Wiseau and The Room. And that kind of boggles the mind. Have you seen The Room? Are you familiar with Tommy and his?
I watched the James Franco movie, the disaster artist. And I think, look, that was before with Ed Wood, for example, you know, when they compared me to Ed Wood. But I think it's just total bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, that is saying what is really annoying for me and totally absurd. And it also, I mean, I love the movie from James Franco. I think it was funny, you know, like Tommy Wiseau was so, like, convinced from his thing. He went fanatically to make it happen. Even, I don't know, till today, nobody knows where the money came from.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting thing. How he got it together and spent so much money on so a crap movie, but at the same time, you know, Ed Wood never had really money to make movies and made like kind of stupid, cultish things, and he only got like kind of celebrated based on the movie with Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
You know, from Tim Burton.
Yeah.
That made him kind of getting famous.
Yeah.
But in my case, I mean, it's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I studied economy. I made 32 movies. The production volume I moved around was $500 million.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I went public in Germany. That is also a thing when you listen only to nerds, then people basically oversee that I'm an absolutely sophisticated business person.
Exactly.
And, you know, I never had a debt. No company from me ever folded.
No.
And that is the thing also where I, with Sean, when I was sitting there and gave a real longer interview to him, I mentioned all of this, but he didn't move further into this chapter because I think it's too boring.
Right.
You know, it's maybe only interesting for actual film people. But I think, of course, that is the real, let's say, sensational thing, what I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of filmmakers, right? So, and I think that a guy from a small town in Germany with no connections to the film industry and not rich parents, basically works his way through it and even solves the financing problem in a way and bring things with Jason Statham and whatever, Christian Slater, Ben Kingsley to life. That is the real, let's say, work I did where I should get credit for.
Yeah.
And bringing all the productions in without owing people money, without screwing people over. I think that was the point. And when they always said, oh, I use German tax money, that is so strong and so idiotic because there was no German tax money they gave to you.
Right.
You had to go around and find investors in your products. And besides me, maybe 200 other directors tried it, but they didn't raise any money because they didn't make profitable movies.
Right.
And that my money growed every year up to In the Name of the King, before then the Germany stopped that kind of investment, was because I returned money to them. You know, and when you read it in the press, even in the sophisticated press about me, it's all written that I abused the tax system or something. It's completely bullshit.
Yeah.
And the fact is that if you, well, let's say you're a dentist, whatever, you invested $100,000 in the film, so then you would not pay taxes on the
$100,000. Right.
So but that means also, and it reduces your income. So you basically save $50,000 taxes. But you still have $50,000 in risk,
right?
And you don't want to lose that. You know, like if my investors would pay taxes, and never, they would still have 50% cash in their hand. So of course nobody invested in any movie in the German tax shelter funds to tank his money, or hoped that the movie would not make revenues. That is completely wrong in the press, on Wikipedia, everywhere. They never digged into it and got it right.
No.
And they all invested to basically to shift paying taxes to a later date. But they all hoped that the movies come in with profit and generate revenues spread over the next, like up to 10 years. So,
yeah.
And that is the thing. And there were so many German funds, mostly from banks or financial institutions, they completely failed. They
yeah.
financed Lord of the Rings. They financed Mission Impossible, whatever. And they never got paid by the studios. They got completely screwed over, the investors.
Yeah.
And I made my own movies, kept the control. And, of course, there were also movies they failed. But everybody got at least 30% back, 60%, one fund, 120%. So at least I created revenues for them, additional to the tax break they got. And they know that I will account properly. So... and that I miss in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, that it's never mentioned what I just told you, basically, what then people can hear in your podcast. But
yeah.
it's just like, I hope that that would be in the movie too.
Yeah. Well, I personally think it's fascinating. I really think you could, we could all profit. Certainly people who love movies and are interested in making movies could profit so much from, you know, lectures from you about... simply producing, forgetting about, you know, obviously you could put, you know, writing and directing and everything else that you do in there, but I think your knowledge and your skills, putting, you know, people I think are very ignorant of how difficult it is to put a film together, not just the financing, but the shooting, the editing, delivery, advertising, you know, the whole package.
Yeah,
I think. Well,
I mean, that is another thing. What I felt when they whatever House of the Dead, Alone in the Dark, when they're getting marketed as like trash, whatever. But they are not. They are like the you know, the crews I had, from the stuntman to the CGI artist. They were all A-list people.
Yeah.
They all have. Like, you know, the Amir Milchin guy who cut Dungeon Siege, he cut it iRobot as
right.
an example. Right? So, and that is the thing. So, Julian Clarke, who cut Postal, got the Oscar for, he did Deadpool later for editing, and he got the Oscar for the thing from South Africa with the, what was the name of it? Was it Guillermo del Toro, like a sci-fi thing of Neil Blomkamp.
Okay.
Did a movie in South Africa, that sci-fi movie.
District 9.
Yeah, District 9. Well, whatever. Like, yeah, so, I mean, that is the thing. It's like completely absurd to say Uwe Boll is like Ed Wood. I mean, I had around me, like, the people I worked with are delivering non-stop movies on the highest level of studio quality. And to say it's total bullshit, it's total trash, it's just wrong.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Alone in the Dark was not a great movie. House of the Dead is not a great movie. They were based on shooter video games, you know, so don't expect too deep of a story. But
yeah.
to say they were totally shit in regards of editing, camera, lighting, CGI, stunts, it's just absurd. It's not the truth.
Yeah.
You know, and that is, I felt like this kind of, in my case, it was so a wave of negativity that it's like completely spaced away from any kind of chance to get a proper, proper credit or a proper analyzing a situation of how that movies got done and how they were distributed and whatsoever. I mean, it's just... and there was a reason at one point I also left that behind me.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's I could not kept reading the reviews and only drag me down. So I just at one point felt like, forget it.
Mm.
If there are things that don't change, there are things that don't change. So focus... the time to convince the critics focus on trying to sell the movies and make some money back.
Yeah. There's one thing I think that's missing from the films that have been made about you, and certainly a lot of the press that's been written about you, is is your utter and complete passion for what you do. I don't think that comes through in anything I've seen or read about you. And yeah. Because I think you're an artist of great passion for what you love, and I don't think that comes across sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing also, like, I mean, there is a German, I wrote a biography, right, but it's only in German language so far, where I really wrote that down, that the reason for me to make movies or to go in the film industry had nothing to do with money at all, and I didn't make any money before I was, like, over 30. So, you know, like, my German movies, I put all my money also in, and time and everything, and we traveled from movie theater to movie theater. You know, like, whatever, you get like $120 from the movie theater, but you have to sleep in the shit hotel on your own cost, and you don't make any money, but you try to build a name for yourself. And this kind of grinding I did for years and years, you don't do this if you're money driven.
No.
You do that if you really want to make it in the film industry, to make the movies and tell the stories you want. And that was the initial motivation when I told my mother when I was 10 I want to make movies. So it has never anything to do with money.
Yeah.
But then when you're actually in the business and you start making movies, you see movies are expensive. So that means the whole time you have to think about money.
Right.
Like, where you get the money from to make a movie. And I just watched, you know, on Netflix, the Orson Welles doku, They Love Me When I'm Dead, right, about Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was cut out from Hollywood, and for me, one of the biggest geniuses of all time in film, and one of the reasons I want to make movies. And then the last 25 years of his life, they basically let him hang cold. And all of his work, all his trying was to get money together.
Yeah.
That was his life, right? He tried to get investors outside of Hollywood, and you know, and that is the reality of the film industry. It's in the end, it boils down to money. And to make it hard for somebody like Orson Welles to get money together is, for me, still the biggest crime Hollywood ever did.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a Van Gogh in front of you with Orson Welles, and they fucking let him basically die.
Yeah.
That is what they did.
Yeah.
And the whole that his Macbeth, Othello, F for Fake, all that stuff was financed in Europe almost with no money. And I mean, what a crime! From, you know, how many people at the Oscars and in the studios would always say, "Oh God, Citizen Kane's the best movie ever." Yeah, but then you have to say, like, "Yeah, but Orson Welles is still alive and want to make movies, and why the fuck you don't give him a penny?"
Exactly.
I mean, that is the thing. What I think is so unbelievable, right? So it's like that the biggest artist who made one of the best films of all times got completely bashed into the ground, forgotten, and nobody gave a shit about it.
Yeah. Well, as he famously once said, it's 99% hustling and 1% movie making. That's no way to spend a life.
Yeah, I agree. And that is the thing. It's a very expensive hobby, right?
Yes.
So and it's too bad that, like, whatever. Let's say Larry Ellison, his daughter Megan Ellison, she whatever got $1 billion, and she produces only crap. Right, so I mean, that is the thing. It's like, why not one of that billionaires is an Uwe Boll fan?
Right.
You know, like, that would help me. But they're all fans of Terrence Malick or whatever, or Paul Thomas Anderson, and then they give them money, and then they make the worst films of their lifetime with the money of the billionaires.
Mm.
I mean, that is the thing. It's so absurd, too. Like, it's almost like if people getting on a different career path, they lose their... right.
Yeah.
And I never did that. Everybody, if you see my movies, they're all very, very gritty and very, very confrontational and direct storytelling. And I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson, There Will Be Blood is my favorite movie of the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And then as soon as he got financed by Annapurna Pictures, he turned into an absolutely idiot. I mean, look at that movie, The Master, or that other stuff with Joaquin Phoenix. But it's a completely crap.
Yeah.
And Terrence Malick is like spaced away in a different dimension of filmmaking, where you feel like, what the fuck is he doing? But he's not telling us a story. He's just like putting music together and faces of prominent actors, and they're all like, "Oh, Terrence Malick, of course I played for you a movie where I say two lines and only stare in the fucking sun." I mean, you know, it's true. I mean, they completely lost it. I mean, it's like, and I think that it's so funny because they are so loved by the reviewers, so the reviewers have so much problems to say how it is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, did you watch Phantom Thread with Daniel Day-Lewis? I mean, how can the same director, actor who did There Will Be Blood shoot a movie like this and don't tell themselves halfway through, what the fuck are we doing?
I know. We don't do a movie.
There is no story to tell. There's just completely BS what we're doing.
I know. I completely agree with you. I believe that There Will Be Blood is one of the last sort of great films that I've seen anyway. But like you said, Terrence Malick and Thomas Anderson, their last films have really been sort of what I consider just art house wanks. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, just kind of like I convinced Megan Ellison, she just gives me $70 million. I shoot whatever the fuck I want and I feel good.
Yeah,
and I pay myself $5 million a director salary, and nobody cares. So I mean, that is the thing where I feel like that is also like, I mean, that line "stay hungry" I think is very important, and they didn't stay hungry. So they you know, like I think you always have to make the movie in a way that it's your last movie.
Yeah,
and you know, like and don't pick mediocre subject matters. Pick things that really matter, and I think you know, this why I stopped after Rampage. I think in Rampage 2 and 3 I turned so political that I mean, I nailed the situation with Donald Trump. Now, I mean, look at Rampage 3, who gets shot right off the bat? It's the President of the United States, and that was before Donald Trump was elected president. And so I think that is the thing. I think I try always to do things that really matter. And Southern Wall Street about the bailouts or the genocide in Sudan. I mean, I did the Darfur movie because the murderers in Sudan are still ruling the country. They never got indicted. They never got arrested. They never, you know, so they hacked 450,000 people into pieces. And because Sudan is not interesting for us, basically,
no,
they stay in power.
Yeah.
You know, and then we go and then get whatever and say Gaddafi has to go or Mubarak in Egypt, better because they are so horrible, horrible dictators. And it's all a cover up for the interest the West has in the oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, I mean, it's so obvious and so absurd. And, I mean, look at now, like, where, how can we have any kind of relationship with Saudi Arab?
Yeah.
I mean, they hacked that guy into pieces, the Khashoggi guy.
Yeah, totally.
And basically murdered him, right? Mm, so, mm. And I mean, how can we continue like nothing happened to countries like this?
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous how I mean, it's really like, I mean, that is the thing what really is on my chest right now. It's really like how the world turns into the most possible catastrophic situation right now, ignoring climate change, and at the same time one democracy after the other turns into a dictatorship.
Yeah.
I mean, where the law, the truth, nothing matters anymore. Free press, freedom of speech, all that gets slowly removed, and we are in bed with the worst countries in the world. I mean, it's proven that all the terrorists of September 11 were Saudis.
Right.
From Osama bin Laden to the pilots, they were all Saudis. They were not Iraqis. They were Saudis. And that are our biggest friends.
Right.
because they invested a lot of money in the stock market and bribed a lot of Donald Trump hotels. I mean, that is the thing. It's like it's completely, it's so dirty that it's really, really make me feel to throw up. I mean, that is the world we're living in right now. So, and there was a different world where I grew up. It was really a world where I think the standing up for principles and moral principles was evenly important, based on all the lessons from the Second World War on, that we cannot, like, bend over only because of money, the main principles of the Constitution, of the we live together, right? And the thing, I think, with Saudi Arab, that they always were bad to the people. They always, executed people in public. So they were always pieces of shit, the Saudis, basically. But with the Khashoggi thing, that was a message from them that they can't kill people in other countries, and getting no penalty for it.
Yeah,
that was the message, and you know what? The message is successful.
Yeah,
I mean, and think about it: the poor people who basically the killer commando. They are all now getting prosecuted in Saudi Arab, and they will all get executed.
Right.
I mean, what is this? Think about it. You are basically a killer commando guy for the Saudi prince. You fly in a private jet to Turkey. You kill a guy, chop him up, and get rid of the body.
Right.
And then you get executed by the guy who told you to do it. And the whole world says, okay, justice is served. Unbelievable. I mean, that is like, that is really like whack the dog style.
It would be
like normal. Normally, you would say that can be only happen in really heavy satires. But no, that is exactly the world we're living in.
No, and people really don't want to deal with it. I mean, it's powerful stuff. It's current, but they'd rather go and see like a Marvel picture or something.
Yeah, I mean, that is what, when you listen to my Uberball Raw thing on YouTube.
Yes, I do. I'm a big fan of yours.
Yeah, you know, the last one I put up yesterday where I said, like, if you think about Wonder Woman or Black Panther, that they made this typical Marvel superhero bullshit and tried to turn it into a movie of women are strong, or Black Lives Matter. And, I mean, it is absurd. I mean, if you just see plainly simple the movies, they are nothing else as, yes, for kids entertaining big CGI-driven action movies.
Yeah.
But there is no second level in Black Panther.
No.
Black Panther is a stupid fucking movie, the same like the Avengers or whatsoever. So, and yes, sometimes it's popcorn movie time and you just don't want to think about it. You watch stuff like this. I have no problem with it. But what I have a problem with is that they try now to make Black Panther like a follower of Martin Luther King or something. I mean, that is the thing I have a problem with.
Right.
That this movie is even getting in the run for best movie of the year. It's like unbelievable that they even think about bullshit like this, and that the same happened with Wonder Woman. I mean, you know, you have in reality, you have a mediocre actor in a miniskirt playing Wonder Woman, and they make it like whatever, all Harvey Weinstein victims love Wonder Woman because the woman is the strong person. I mean, what the fuck is wrong with all that people? Yeah. And that is also with the in a way with what happened to the press and because they're also part of conglomerates now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like they also lost any kind of bite. They know that it could be a big problem if they actually release a review of a movie like Black Panther that is a complete piece of shit, 0 out of 5 stars in the Washington Post. That will have consequences.
Yes.
You know, that would have consequences. So they all try, and I see that in various movies since years and years now, where they try to squeeze something positive out of where nothing positive is in, and give it 2 stars or 3 stars out of 5, so that they get away with it.
Right.
You you know. So, and yeah, that is very interesting to see that. Mm. But that is also a big symptom, a big problem we have in regards of reporting.
Totally. So now, Dr. Bollett, you're not making pictures anymore, and you can simply go to the movies or watch movies. You know, probably the way you did before you started making movies yourself. Are you enjoying watching films simply as a viewer again, instead of having
Absolutely. I mean, I'm all my life I watched films and TV shows and so on. And if a story can get me in, so basically that I have a real like a blast watching it. I'm also like a victim of binge watching on some stuff where I really like whatever, watch 10 episodes in 2 days. And I mean, that is the thing. I'm of course watching a lot, but there's also a lot of stuff what you basically can watch only if you read something parallel or make some emails, because it's just too boring, or a lot of stuff what gets shot you already know after 10 minutes in what direction it goes.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of time for the fast forward button. And I mean, that is the reality. And but I'm always on the hunt for things that grab my attention and keep my attention. And then I enjoy it. And then I'm happy that I watched the movie, or happy that I watched the TV show.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to end, Dr. Boll, because I have always loved and enjoyed your work. I'm very glad to have had a chance to talk with you this morning. It's sad in many ways that you won't be making movies anymore, but I'm so grateful that you did make movies and that those films will last forever. And I wish you all the best with your. I know you're a restaurateur now. You have a wonderful restaurant, and you're hoping to open more, I understand? More restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, we maybe open one more restaurant, but I'm not in, let's say this way, it's you cannot compare it to the movies.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's nice to have a restaurant, it's good food, you have, like, different kind of problems in a restaurant, but for me as the owner, like, when I set everything up and I got the people together and so on, then I'm there now to bring guests in, and always when we put a new menu up, I tell my opinion, we maybe change some items or change some dishes how they are. But overall, it's not so work intense as making a movie.
Yeah. Anyway, look, God bless you, sir.
Okay, perfect. Thanks so much. Okay.
No worries.
Bye.
Bye-bye.